From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this is Politically Georgia. I'm Bill Nygut. There's no telling when or if the Trump-Fulton County election conspiracy trial will begin. But on Monday, the first criminal case against a former president gets underway in a New York City courtroom. Trump faces charges of violating campaign spending laws by making hush money payments to a porn star.
I'm Greg Bluestein. Many legal experts say it's the weakest of the four criminal trials Trump is facing, but it also may be the only one that will take place before the November election.
We'll talk to veteran Georgia District Attorney Bob Wilson to get his take on the upcoming trial.
Then we'll answer your questions from our listener mailbag and tell you who's up and who's down this week.
We invite you to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode of Politically Georgia.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over four decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.
Let's get right to the news of the day and of the week. We know that the Fulton County election conspiracy case against Donald Trump in Fulton County is facing legal hurdles before a trial date can be set. There are some people who believe there may never be a trial based on whatever happens in Trump's efforts to get immunity from the Supreme Court to fight the Fulton County charges against him. So that's on hold for the time being in terms of an actual trial moving forward. But on Monday morning, Donald Trump becomes the first president to be prosecuted on criminal charges when the hush money trial gets underway in a Manhattan courtroom. Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in an effort to hide payments he made to stop porn star Stormy Daniels from revealing her claims of an affair with Trump. And if he's found guilty on any of these charges, he could face jail time. So we want to talk about that. And to do it, we wanted to bring in one of our favorite attorneys in Georgia, former district attorney in DeKalb County, the Stone Mountain Judicial Circuit, for three terms. Before that, a public defender and a man who knows the law as well as anybody that you and I, Greg, know. And that's Bob Wilson, who we're very happy to welcome to the show today. Bob, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Bill and Greg. Good to see you both.
So let's start trying to unpack just a little about what's happening in this case. There are many people who consider this the least significant of the four trials that Trump faces, the charges against him in other venues. It's based on the fact that he did authorize hush money payments to Stormy Daniels in advance of the 2016 election. And then his business made an effort to cover up what that money was used for. And one of the things that Alvin Bragg, the district attorney, has charged in this case is that this was an illegal campaign donation to the Trump campaign. But there are several factors that make this a felony rather than a misdemeanor in terms of falsifying business records. So help us understand a little bit about all this, Bob.
That's a bit of the complications of the case. There are 34 counts, as you said, and they all deal with the checks that were written by Michael Cohen as Trump's attorney out of his own accounts to Stormy Daniels. But it also deals with the bills that he submitted and were processed by the Trump Organization, and then the recording of those payments in the Trump Organization through some of them, a trust account that Trump had and other organization accounts. It's to make this a felony, the falsification of documents has to be tied to some kind of fraud or other illegal activity. And there's really three claimed here. One is, you're correct, an illegal campaign contribution. In other words, an allegation that he has breached federal campaign laws, but also that he breached state campaign laws, and also that he breached state tax laws by doing this. Now, clearly, there's a subpart to this case of what we might call in Georgia similar transactions that are, I think, being overshadowed in the news, but I think will be highly important in their presentation to the jury. And that is when we get to the payments that were made by the National Enquirer to Karen McDougal and to a gentleman who was a doorkeeper at the Trump Towers about things they claim, sort of the catch and kill prospect of buying a story and then not running it, as similar transactions, because those go to the idea that the catch and kill of buy the story but then not use it is to tuck it away so that as the campaign goes forward and gets closer to election, these stories don't come out. And all of this was after the famous interview with Donald Trump that dealt with how he could grab and touch women in ways that was highly inappropriate. And so this would have been highly explosive. So to support those secondary aspects of the charge to make them a felony, McDougal and the Dorman's matters come in through David Pecker, who was the publisher for the Enquirer.
McDougal,
so it gets complicated. I may have explained to you.
No, I think you really did that well for us. McDougal, of course, another woman who was allegedly having an affair with Trump.
Right.
And there was part, that was catch and kill, that she wanted to tell her story. And the Enquirer bought it and then didn't use it. And then the doorman, who alleged that Trump, he knew that Trump had had an illegitimate child, which I think was later proven to be false. And nevertheless, there was an effort to pay him off to be quiet about it.
Yeah. Well, he was paid $30,000, yes, supposedly, and McDougal was paid $150,000, yeah, supposedly. The purpose of that evidence is support for this claim that all of this was done in relation to Stormy Daniel for political reasons. And that in doing that, instead of it being a campaign contribution paying her, it was treated as a business deduction, as if it was a legal fee paid to Michael Cohen. And that's not really what it was.
And Bob, as I understand it, you know, these charges all trace back to, when it comes to Stormy Daniels, $130,000 payment. But as I understand it, paying hush money is not always illegal. It is the fact that, or is the contention that this came under, while Donald Trump was serving as the commander in chief, and it was how he constituted, how he paid his fixer, Michael Cohen, how he did that, that constituted fraud. Is that a correct understanding?
I would say that that's basically correct. But what's happened is you, on a company's books, you are seeing that a legal expense was allegedly paid to Michael Cohen for legal services. That's not what it was, at least according to Alvin Bragg's indictment. So if he can prove that that payment of $420,000, not a single payment, it's a series of payments paid to Cohen for these bills and invoices he submitted, along with an alleged retainer agreement, which is falsified according to Cohen, that it was really so that he could transmit the money to Stormy Daniel in order to keep her quiet and give him sufficient money to pay the taxes on the money he was being given to pay her. Because as I understand the evidence, Cohen took out a line of credit on his own home to pay the payments to Stormy Daniel. Now he's being paid back. In no way is that a legal service, if you will, from the standpoint of him being paid for the service he renders, is for him to pay somebody to kill the story. And so for that reason, that's the complexity of the case. All of that's going to have to be conveyed to a jury, and they're going to have to argue about the federal campaign law, the state campaign law, the state tax laws, to say that doing that violated those because he was taking a tax deduction for a business expense, which was not recorded correctly, obviously, if that is true.
Bob, let me, if you don't mind, put you in the position of Alvin Bragg, just for the sake of discussion. Okay. Your chief witness, apparently, is Michael Cohen, a longtime associate of Donald Trump, a fixer for Donald Trump, who, of course, had a complete and well-publicized falling out with him. Cohen went to jail for some of his activities related to Donald Trump. If you're prosecuting this case, how much do you believe Michael Cohen's testimony will be undercut by very aggressive defense arguments that he's got a grudge against Donald Trump, that they're enemies at this point? Do you think that Michael Cohen will be your most reliable witness, which is what apparently Alvin Bragg thinks he has to be?
The answer to that is a yes and a no. The yes is he needs to be one of his most reliable witnesses. The no is he's coming in with a lot of battle scars that make him pretty ugly. That does not mean he's not believable. I mean, we once had to try a case where the prostitute was alleging she was raped. What's one of the first things she did in front of the jury? She explained what she did for a living, who she was, how she made that living, how she became to get into that business. She had to lay out who she really was. Mm-hmm. Michael Cohen has to sit before that jury and explain all of those self-inflicted wounds he put on himself by the wrongs that he did and the price that he's paid for it. You can't hide who he has been. That does not mean he's necessarily not being truthful now. The defense will do everything they possibly can, and they've got a lot to work with to undercut him because he has been known to lie.
We're here with Bob Wilson, who served three terms as the DeKalb County District Attorney and is a founding member of Wilson, Morton, and Downs. Bob, what could this trial mean for the Fulton County election interference case? Because I know they're obviously involving very different criminal matters, but I'm sure the prosecutorial team over in Fulton County will be watching everything that happens very closely.
You know, that's a good question, Greg. Bill said some people think this is the weakest of the cases and so forth. At the moment, since this is the one that's most important, and maybe the only one for
Bob, we're getting interference right now. Tell you what,
is that better?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. My apologies. But I think the Fulton case is hinging right now upon whether or not the Court of Appeals of Georgia is going to take the request for appeal. The judge gave them permission to knock on the Court of Appeals door over his failure or his refusal to take Fannie Willis herself off the case. The Court of Appeals now has to decide whether they're going to let that appeal come in or not. If it says no, it'll go back and this thing will get scheduled for some time. If it says yes, that case is in a dead stop. So I don't know it's going to have any impact on it at this particular point, Greg. Mm-hmm. In the long run, there may be some analysis after this case is over that will be helpful to that case on how to proceed with it. At the moment, Alvin Bragg is out there by himself under the pressure to lead this ship forward. And anything, I will say this, anything can happen in this particular trial because you have a completely unpredictable and I think uncontrollable by his own lawyers, defendant in the case. And I have tried cases with folks who had clients they could not control and who were unpredictable, and anything can happen.
And they weren't former presidents.
No, so. No, and they weren't former presidents with that stature.
Hey, Bob. So
it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, it sure is. Bob, we got a similar situation, I think, if the Fulton County case ever comes to a trial that they have in New York, and that is selecting a jury that can be neutral. And I'm wondering, again, as prosecutor of this case in New York, my hypothetical for you, how confident would you be that a jury can be selected, in your case as prosecutor, that won't come in with certain biases towards Donald Trump? How does the defense deal with people who come in, they don't like Donald Trump? And how can you really come up with questions that will get to the bottom of that and convince everybody or make it clear this is a neutral jury willing to decide on the facts?
That is an extremely hard thing to do. The sides are going to come in looking for different things. I think that the state will look for people who are a little better educated, maybe college degrees or more, in decision-making roles in their life, what kind of work they've done that might lead them to have to make a lot of decisions. I think that the defense side will come in looking for a little less educated. There are those that think that he will be looking on that side for minorities who may feel that they've been discriminated against by the justice system and by law enforcement, that he may be looking more for blue-collar workers. In the end, though, you're trying to achieve three things if you can get it. You want somebody who's going to be fair, impartial, and will decide the case only on the evidence presented in that courtroom. Mm. But you've got to have people who have a backbone. Mm-hmm. They either have, for the defense, they want a backbone, somebody who can stand up to others and say, I'm not going there. I don't think that's right because I don't think the evidence adds up to that. But on the state side, you want people who will say, this is a hard thing to do, but we must do it if they think the evidence is there. It's going to be very difficult. There are people who tell you they can read body language and that they can decide who's going to do this and that. In the end, the lawyers who are on the point have to watch and listen to the answers they get and read those jurors carefully. Are they serious-minded people? Do they take this duty because they're a citizen and they want to do what's right, whatever that may be? And are they willing to be fair and listen to everything, even if it goes against what they want it to be? You've got to find those people, and it's hard.
Greg?
Bob Wilson, I want to go back to something you said earlier. You've had, as a defense attorney, as a prosecutor, you've had defendants, clients who have been uncontrollable witnesses and defendants, I should say. You've never had a former president, so this is uncharted territory.
Thankfully.
Thankfully. So this is uncharted territory for the folks up in up north. But at the same time, as an attorney, as a veteran attorney, how do you kind of limit the damage of those uncontrollable defendants? What do you do? You've never had a client that has their own social media platform, but still, as an attorney, what advice do you try to give to kind of limit that damage?
Well, this one has a prong to it I haven't had to deal with, and that is that that particular client is not only on trial for his liberties and for felony, serious felony charges, he's got a political realm to him that he's running in both circuits at the same time. He doesn't want to be found guilty, but if he's found guilty, he wants to be able to handle it somehow to a political advantage if he can. My way of handling is to have frank and honest conversations with a client that says, this is serious business. There's more involved here than your politics, as far as I'm concerned. It's your backside and whether you're going to be a convicted felon and whether or not you're going to keep yourself, if you become one, out of being incarcerated.
Bob,
and so you must take this process seriously and behave accordingly.
I apologize for interrupting. We have time for one last quick question, if I may. You've certainly been involved in high-profile cases with a lot of public interest as district attorney. Just how difficult is Alvin Bragg's position, and what's it like to be under such scrutiny as a district attorney in a very high-profile case like this? What does it mean to your life as this is all unfolding?
What it means to your life as it's unfolding is that you dedicate yourself to the work at hand, and you do what you can and what you have to do during that time period to focus on that. Your family has to understand, your wife, your husband, whoever you're involved with, your children, and you have to have some breaks from it, but you must dedicate yourself to the purpose at hand. It's whether you're playing in a minor golf tournament or the Masters, the pressure is great. You got to focus on the game when you're out on the course. When you come to that courthouse, you have to eat, sleep, drink this case. You have to think through every scenario that could possibly happen. And no one can do that in this case because of the unpredictability of the defendant, including the judge.
Bob Wilson, it's really been a pleasure to talk to you. I was thinking as we talked, you were one of the first district attorneys I ever talked to when I got to Georgia way back in 1983. Greg Bluestein covered you when he was an Associated Press reporter covering the district attorney, covering the circuit out there. So we both count you as a longtime contact and someone we've always enjoyed working with.
From way back at the Daily Report as well, back in 2004.
Bob Wilson, thanks so much for being with us.
I'll be watching the case with interest.
Yeah, well, we'll invite you back at some point. Thanks, Bob. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach. An air freshener can make your car smell like paradise. A drive to Daytona Beach will actually get you there. Beach on. Plan your trip today at DaytonaBeach.com.
Welcome back to the Friday. That's right, the Friday edition of Politically Georgia. After a long week of politics, the AJC politics team is going to get a little break over the weekend. Although you, Bluestein, you're running in another race tomorrow. Do you ever stop running?
We got the Mimosa 5K tomorrow morning, right before the Dogwood Festival in Piedmont Park.
All right. Well, I always like reading about these races that you and your daughters, you drag them out there with you.
And this time my wife is going to run it too.
Oh, so
the whole family.
God. Well, you also at one point had Natalie Mendenhall run with you.
And we're going to get her back.
All right. Enough of that. Let's get back to some significant news here. Greg, you were at the hotel when the private luncheon, fundraising luncheon, took place the other day with Trump in town. And it's interesting to me that while Biden, as many stories have reported, has raised far more money nationally than Donald Trump, this luncheon raised at least you've told us at $5 million. And in Georgia, it appears that Trump has a fundraising lead over Joe Biden, right?
Yeah, in Georgia, Donald Trump has outraised Joe Biden nationally. He hasn't. That's what really matters. But in Georgia, Donald Trump is now leveraging those gains with this fundraiser that raised more than $5 million. But look, Bill, that national fundraising advantage that Joe Biden has is daunting for Donald Trump. not just because there's a huge money advantage, but also because so much of what Donald Trump is raising has to go back into what we just talked about in the first segment, his legal bills. And that is a complicating factor. And Joe Biden doesn't have that same problem. So Joe Biden has been spending the money he's raising, he can pump right back into his grassroots, to his TV ads, to hiring staffers. And that matters. As we heard earlier this week from Jenna Wortel, who is Joe Biden's top advisor in Georgia, you know, that money is going right to opening offices, paying for TV and media messaging, paying for digital ads that directly target certain types of voters, and of course hiring staffers to go get the message out and to go build those grassroots organizations that, as we've talked about, you know, the Democrats can't rely on Fair Fight, can't rely on some of the other left-leaning organizations as much as they have in previous years because those groups are now diminished.
Eric Tannenblatt, our friend, who's a Republican and one of the biggest bundlers in the Southeast, and by bundler, we're talking about the people who go out for mega donations from a variety of people and give them to a candidate to raise that money for people like George W., H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Mitt Romney. So, but what's interesting about that is that, of course, he was out there raising money for Nikki Haley and is not likely to turn around and tap those same mega donors in Georgia, for example, to give to the Trump campaign. So there's money left on the table on the Republican side, even though Trump continues to outraise Biden here in Georgia. I don't want to name individuals, but Eric did have a number of very wealthy donors giving to the Haley campaign. It'll be unlikely they'll turn around and give it to Trump.
And we'll be able to see that by the end of the cycle. Some of them might not give at all. Some of them might still give, but not as much as they would have given if Nikki Haley was the nominee. Yeah. But look, Donald Trump's got mega donors as well here in Georgia. Bernie Marcus is one of them. Kelly Loeffler, the former U.S. Senator. Between her and her husband, Jeff Sprecher, they've given about $2 million already to Donald Trump this cycle alone, to Trump and his associated campaigns. So we're talking about huge money. You know, we're also talking about huge legal bills.
So
there's a lot. And look, even competing in a state like Georgia, think about it this way, Bill. In 2020, just in Georgia alone, about $1 billion was spent between the Senate campaigns, the Senate runoffs, and the presidential campaign.
It's outrageous when you think about that kind of money. The luncheon, just keep talking about that for a minute. You pointed out on the show the other day that there were any number of people who were there because they have higher ambitions themselves, among them Kelly Loeffler, who you told me, I was thinking maybe Kelly Loeffler runs for Senate in 2026, but you said to me, no, she's more likely to be a candidate for governor.
Yeah, that's my gut at this point. Remember, with the specter of Governor Brian Kemp maybe running for U.S. Senate, that's going to block a lane for a lot of these Republicans. There's very few that would of credible Republicans that would go against him at this point. If he doesn't run for Senate, then it opens that lane up. Then Kelly Loeffler and others might talk about that more. But right now, I'm looking at a potential three or four prominent figure battle for governor. That's Attorney General Chris Carr. That's Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones. That's Kelly Loeffler. And that could involve also Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. Right now, there's those different lanes. Chris Carr, Brad Raffensperger, they steered clear of the Donald Trump fundraiser. Raffensperger isn't endorsing anyone. Carr did endorse Donald Trump, but only after he cemented the nomination. And then you've got Kelly Loeffler and Burt Jones, who are both running, embracing Donald Trump as they move forward in their political careers.
You know, I've mentioned this before on the show, I know, but when we talk about Brian Kemp maybe running for Senate in 2026, it takes me back to thinking about Governor Zell Miller. Governors often become very frustrated when they run and win a seat in the U.S. Senate because they've been the CEO of a state. And in the Senate, they're merely one of 100 people. And I remember a visit I made to Zell when he was up in the Senate. And we sat in his office. It was pretty late one evening, and it was kind of an off-the-record informal conversation. And he made it clear he was miserable. In fact, he was thinking about writing a book about what happens to former governors who go into the Senate and getting there and interviewing them to talk about their similar feelings that They don't have the power they had when they ran the state.
And, Bill, that was a couple of decades ago. It's gotten worse. Yeah. There are people very close to Senator John Ossoff, who's up in 2026, who are just saying Brian Kemp wouldn't want this job even in the trust, you know? But that's exactly right. Look, David Perdue is a perfect example of that. He got up to Washington and couldn't stop talking about how frustrated he was, because to get anything significant done, you not only have to have a majority vote, you now have to get above that 60 vote filibuster threshold for much controversial legislation, unless there's all sorts of procedural maneuvers. A very frustrating job for someone who is used to hands-on CEO type experience,
yeah,
like David
like
Perdue,
David Perdue,
a Fortune 500 former CEO, and like Brian Kemp, who's now had, you know, is now in the middle of a second term. Yeah. As a very powerful governor, because in Georgia, governors have immense power, yeah, to shape the agenda, to appoint people to boards, to use executive action, and of course, to sign or veto legislation.
So you don't imagine Perdue's going to run for office again. He, of course, was at the luncheon. You think it's more likely he might want to be a member of a cabinet if Donald Trump becomes president?
Yeah, there's a couple things going on, and I'll have a story about that coming up in the next couple days. But there's a couple things there. One is he could also just be seeking some form of political redemption. Mm-hmm. You know, he lost by 52 points to Governor Kemp in the 2022 primary. That's humiliating. That's a thrashing, right? That's a very humbling defeat. And he went, you know, kind of into retreat. We have not heard or seen much of David Perdue until the last few weeks, until really the Rome rally that Donald Trump held last month, where David Perdue was one of the featured speakers. Mm-hmm. That's a contrast from the other failed candidates in 2021. Doug Collins wrote a book. He has a podcast. He's been out there. He might run for office again. And then, of course, Kelly Loeffler is very much out there. And shortly after her defeat, she started what she hoped was the Republican answer to Stacey Abrams' Fair Fight organization called Greater Georgia, which is basically Republican get-out-the-vote outreach.
Yeah, which I think she deserves some credit for. You know, when she was appointed to that job by Governor Kemp, which and then lost it, of course, there was almost a sense, at least that I had, well, here's a very wealthy woman who's sort of a dilettante dabbling in politics in Washington in a very prestigious role. That's not what she's done at all. She's really out there working the grassroots to try to build a significant organization. Whether you agree with her politics or not, I've frankly been pretty impressed that she takes this seriously.
She really seems all in. She is a billionaire whose husband is the CEO of the company that owns the New York Stock Exchange. Mm-hmm. She has a private jet, as we've much reported on. She could be spending her weekends in Bali. She's in Bainbridge. She could be hanging out in Monaco. She's in Moultrie. So she is out in the grassroots. And there's a lot of, particularly in the Georgia Senate, there's a lot of Georgia Senate Republicans who owe her a lot because she's helped them raise money. She's helped get their message out. And Bill, you know, just in a few days, she has a award ceremony for a lot of lawmakers that only political insiders really know the ins and outs of, but she's helping promote them. And she's also hoping that they remember her in a couple
sure,
years.
Of course.
Because she's no longer sort of this new figure on the Georgia stage, yeah, especially after $1 billion was spent in Georgia in 2020, either promoting her and her allies or tearing them down.
Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned Chris Carr. We know that Chris Carr is already made it clear he's going to run for governor in 2026.
He hasn't said he'll run, but he's made it clear behind the scenes
that's right. Yes. He's right. Nothing official, but he's out and about a lot. He was not at the luncheon, but Burt Jones was there, and Burt Jones, we suspect, is going to run for governor. We reported yesterday that after what, 2 years? Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, Judge Robert McBurney in Fulton County dismissed him, Burt Jones, took him out of the Fannie Willis Fulton County election conspiracy case. He was a target of Fannie Willis's investigation, but McBurney removed him because of what he called a conflict of interest, because Fannie Willis had held a fundraiser for a Democratic opponent. What's interesting is it was a primary fundraiser. Charlie
Bailey.
Bailey had not been named. He hadn't won the right to challenge Burt Jones, But even as a primary candidate, Fani Willis said, no, you can't do that. I mean, Judge McBurney said, Fani Willis, it's a conflict. We're removing Burt Jones. Two years later.
Judge McBurney basically said he was stupefied that Fani Willis would do this, would co-host a fundraiser, would put her name, would lend her reputation towards Charlie Bailey, who, as you mentioned, was a Democrat running for lieutenant governor at the time. Also, though, they have a long history. They worked together in the Fulton DA's office as line prosecutors. Yep. So this wasn't a situation where Fani Willis kind of went out of her way. This was something where Charlie Bailey asked an old friend of his to co-host a fundraiser. But at the same time, you know, judge found it as a clear conflict of interest, disqualified her from taking up this case.
Yeah, so Burt Jones has had a free ride for all that time, became lieutenant governor of the state of Georgia, launched an investigation of Fani Willis. He's got a special committee with subpoena powers to investigate Fani Willis. There are other actions in which he's undermining Fani Willis. And we have all been asking, when is Pete Skandalakis, the head of the prosecuting attorney's counsel, going to name a new district attorney to prosecute this case? And we've been somewhat, I don't know if we've been critical of him, but we've certainly questioned why he's not moving to get this investigation of Jones in the hands of another DA.
Yeah, and this was the example we used when the other Fulton County judge, Judge McAfee, was considering whether to disqualify Fani Willis and her office from even going forward on the broader case of how complicated it would be to find another attorney to take this case. Because if it took 2 years just for Pete Skandalakis, to decide to appoint himself to investigate these charges, then imagine an overall much broader case, how long it could take. We had a number of DAs go on the record saying they don't want anything to do with investigating Burt Jones, some because of resources and the threats and the public scrutiny it would bring. Others, though, of course, you're also going against, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you also know you're going against one of the most powerful politicians in Georgia, someone who, as the president of the state Senate, has a lot of control over how DAs and how public safety is funded in Georgia.
Burt Jones has said he's glad, he welcomes Pete Skandalakis taking up this investigation, because it will prove that Fani Willis is just a political hack. He didn't use that expression.
He almost did, though. And Bill, you are, he didn't call it an investigation. He called it a charade.
Yes.
And he essentially did kind of say that. He said, Fani Willis has made a mockery of this legal process, as she tends to do. I look forward to a quick resolution and moving forward with the business of the state of Georgia. That's Burt Jones. He wants to get this behind him. But Bill, this could help him in some ways, of course. It's a lot like Donald Trump, how, you know, to a big segment of the audience, of the electorate, this is awful. To a big segment, though, they see this as political persecution, something that he could use as a rallying point, something that he could use to mobilize MAGA Republicans in a potential race in 2026 against someone like Kelly Loeffler.
All right, we got to get to a break, but one last thing. Whether Pete Skandalakis decides that Jones should be indicted or not, I think the expression for the lieutenant governor is, you can run, but you can't hide, Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones. Let's take a break. When we come back, Greg, you and I are going to answer questions from listeners, and we'll pick our ups and downs for the week. This is Politically Georgia.
Hip-hop is a product of black people. It's a product of black song and celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents
hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop story.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny.
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at ajc.com/hip-hop.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I'm Bill Nygut with co-host Greg Bluestein. Twice daily, delivered straight to your email, you can receive the AJC's Politically Georgia newsletter. Stay on top of all the important news, scoops, and exclusives from the AJC politics team. Just go to ajc.com/newsletters and sign up today. That's ajc.com/newsletters. Greg Bluestein, we just have a few minutes left to do two of our favorite segments on every Friday. First of all, we're going to take some questions from listeners who've sent you and I some emails. Natalie Mendenhall, what have we got?
Not a lot of calls this week, but we do have some great emails, and it's always great to be on the other side of the air with you. So Bruce from Marietta says, while it may be a convenient position to allow the states to decide this issue, abortion, by passing the buck, Donald Trump is setting up this nation to become even more polarized than he's already made it. He asks, is Trump being intentional here with this decision?
Greg Bluestein.
Yes, I get the hard one. First, at least. Well, look, I mean, it's been said many times by Republicans and Democrats. It looks like Donald Trump is playing both sides of this issue, right? He is saying that it's up to states. It's out of his hands. But at the same time, we have plenty of remarks from him in the past where he's wavered, where he has seemed to support national abortion restrictions, where he's criticized states for not going far enough. And then, guys, Bill, even yesterday or even Wednesday when he was in Atlanta and asked about the Arizona 160-year-old abortion ban that was upheld by that state's Supreme Court, he said it goes too far and he wants states to move very quickly and rein it back. So he's saying it's up to states, but he's also now saying he also wants to interfere with those states'
rights. It's sort of like how he says elections are legal if I win them, but not if I lose them. States should decide, but in the case of Arizona, maybe you shouldn't have decided. Natalie, what else have we got?
All right, we have Roger from the Lake Claire neighborhood saying, it is clear we have millions of undocumented folks coming across the border. My question is, why is there scant coverage by any media that I read, which includes who employs those people coming across the border?
You know, Roger, I think that's a fair and interesting question. And I think there's a couple of answers to it. I mean, first of all, a lot of the undocumented workers who come into this country and who are employed by companies that otherwise may not be able to do their business as well as they need to, we don't know who they are until there's an ICE raid, for instance, that arrests those people. We do know that there are there are farmers who are employing, in some cases, undocumented immigrants, and we talk about that. A lot of times they actually come in protected by a special government program. But it's harder than you would imagine to actually say which companies are hiring undocumented
people. And because a lot of these companies and agricultural concerns end up hiring third-party vendors and it's really hard to track that down. But, Bill, that also speaks to why there hasn't been any more severe, more limiting anti-immigration crackdowns in Georgia, because a lot of the opposition comes from rural Georgia Republicans who worry about their constituents who are farmers who won't be able to get the labor they need to produce their crops each year.
All right. By the way, if you have a question that you want to give us on our hotline, just call 770-810-5297, 770-810-5297, and we'll get to your questions on Friday. All right, Greg. Time for our final moments of this week. Who's up and who's down? Who's down in your book, Greg?
Well, Bill, we talked a lot about how we've been on the road a lot, covering different things this week. Well, I was on the road going also to a sex shop. And I'll tell you why, and that's my who's down. Republican outreach centers.
Maybe you better
not. So Republican outreach centers are who's down. With great fanfare, the RNC opened a string of offices in Metro Atlanta designed to reach out to Black, Hispanic, and Asian American voters. Now all three of those offices in the ATL have been shuttered. I visited the location of one of them, an office that once held pastor roundtables in Gwinnett County. Now it's a sex toy shop. Very nice operators. One of them, we have mutual friends. But it shows you the limits of the GOP outreach programs.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm going to choose the obvious one. Marjorie Taylor Greene. She came back to a session this week with a 5-page searing letter condemning Speaker Mike Johnson, saying it's time to get rid of him. He's really a Democrat in disguise, essentially. And the problem is she may have jumped the shark on this one. She's not getting much support from other Republicans. And there are some folks up there who are saying we're getting a little tired of her act. And when Patricia went to her town meeting mm-hmm. in Tunnel Hill, she talked to some of Marjorie Taylor Greene's constituents who think the world of her, but they think she's way off base on this Mike Johnson thing. So I think she's my down for the week.
They say she's on an island.
Who's your up?
Well, I'm going to go personal. As my bubby would say, I'm felling. My wife and her team at Emory Healthcare, which won a coveted Best in Real Estate Award from the Atlanta Business Chronicle last night for the new cancer center in Midtown that she helped oversee. It was a really fantastic evening and a great way to honor an important addition to our city's healthcare infrastructure.
Cheryl is a really powerful member of that Emory team. Congratulations.
Thank you. And I will pass that along to her.
Okay, please do. I'm going to give mine to, I know that what I'm about to say is going to get virtually no chance of passage in Congress, but I am going to give props to Senator John Fetterman, Jack Reed, and a couple of others who believe that American nonprofit theater is so vital to our understanding of who we are as people, to elevating our spirits, to helping us understand the problems and the ways in which we deal with life. They have a proposal to give $1 billion to nonprofit theaters around the country that are struggling to stay in business. And these are theaters that really do bring communities together. This is going nowhere, but just the fact that they understand how important theater, which, as you know, Greg, is one of my great loves, I give them my up for the week. All right, that's it. Greg, we're out of time for today's Politically Georgia. Good luck on your run tomorrow. I'll be sitting at home watching TV. We're out of time for today's show, but we'll be back with you on Monday when Michael Thurman and Eric Tannenblatt will join us. So I hope you'll be with us then. As always, thank you so much for listening to Politically Georgia. You can hear Politically Georgia live weekday mornings at 10 on 90.1 WABE in Atlanta, or do what you're doing right now. Follow Politically Georgia on your favorite podcast app and hear new episodes every afternoon. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review and share Politically Georgia with a friend. Join us again on Monday for Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Ocean breeze, tropical beach, piña colada. You can buy an air freshener to make your car smell like you're in an oceanside paradise. Or, better yet, you can point your car toward Daytona Beach and come experience the real thing. Visit DaytonaBeach.com to discover all there is to see, do, and enjoy along the world's most famous beach, Daytona Beach, Florida. Beach on.
Donald Trump has been indicted in Atlanta.
We have so many court dockets to follow, but we haven't really seen anything yet.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has covered every moment of this historic case.
I've been writing about this investigation for 2.5 years.
Our team is led by reporters Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman. Follow our coverage on AJC.com and listen to new in-depth episodes of the award-winning podcast, Breakdown, The Trump Indictment, only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.